Tim mentions children almost being the canary in the cage of a community. If children are playing happily, then you know you have a community that is thriving.
Hi there, I'm Tom Hall from Active Gloucestershire. I'm here today with Ben Morris, Director of Play at Play Gloucestershire, who are a charity who deliver active and creative outdoor play sessions to young people and families all across Gloucestershire. And in our conversation today, we're going to explore what play, play nurture and play therapy actually is. How can young people get more access to play through their families, through their schools and their communities? We'll also spend a little bit of time looking at how community programmes, including play, are increasingly a part of how our NHS is reforming to provide conditions in which people can be healthy through healthier communities. And also we'll explore how we can all build play into our communities and environments anywhere outside our homes. And that could be our streets, our housing estates and our parks. I really, really enjoyed chatting to Ben today. It was a real pleasure to tap into his insight and knowledge and experience. And I really hope you enjoy listening to this podcast as much as we enjoyed making it. Ben Morris, how are you doing?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
It's great to have you here. We've talked about doing this for a long time. Really looking forward to getting into a little bit of your world. So just to kick us off, if someone says to you, Ben, what is play? What would you say?
Play is very individual. I think if you asked myself for a definition, I could give you one definition. If you asked your colleagues, they would give you another definition. Play is complex for that reason. So therefore, to define it, it's an individual thing. And that is what play is. Play is built within all of us. It's innate. But to define it, I guess, you know, in the playwork world, we define play as something, as I said, that is intrinsically motivated, something that is inside of you, something you want to do. So therefore, it's something where you find a state of flow, where you are immersed in play. And that's probably the best definition that we use in a playwork world.
So in terms of young people we're trying to work with and support, can you give me some examples of how and where you might help young people through play?
Play is something everyone does, regardless of age. Play can be defined, as we said, in different things. So you and I might play by immersing ourselves in a book. We might sit with friends in a cafe or a bar. Play for children is where they meet their world head on. So whereas adults, as I say, we lose ourselves in a book to shield ourselves away from the daily grind and mortgages and this, that, and the other, children meet their world head on. So whatever's going on in their world, they use play as a way to work it out. So you might have a young person that is going through bereavement of a parent. They will use play as a way of testing their own physical and emotional abilities through play. Likewise, children for the last 2 years have had control taken away from them with the restrictions that we've all been living through. So a sense of autonomy has been taken away. Play gives them that control again. So free play, something that the playwork world stick our flag in the ground and say, this is the most important thing for young people. Free play gives them the ability to choose what they do and how they do it. They then learn from the mistakes that they make. So a physical example could be climbing a tree. You put your foot on the wrong branch, the branch snaps. You learn then that you need to put your foot on a thicker branch. In an emotional sense, I think we've all probably done it. You might say something to a friend thinking you're funny, but then through their reaction, you go, oh, I'm only joking. And you turn it playful because you realize you've stepped a little bit too far. Play is that all the time. It's give and take, it's break, it's remake. And therefore, allowing young people control to take that element into their hands is a huge tool, both in terms of their physical abilities, but also their emotional resilience.
Okay, so just to try and paint a picture for anyone who's listening then, can you give us an example of what this might look like, for example, in a school setting?
Yeah, absolutely. So play nurture is where we go into a school and we will work with children that the school have identified might be struggling through whatever reason, as we've touched on before. It could be bereavement. It could be just struggling at school. It could be additional needs. One child that springs to mind, he was referred into our project working one-on-one with a TA, so he couldn't engage in the classroom atmosphere. So they referred him into a play nurture group where we work with children, maximum group of 10, and we just give them that control that I touched on earlier. And over a course of weeks, he built his own self-confidence, he built friendships, and actually he built trust in us as play workers as well. And we work at the speed of trust. So we don't try and force anything on young people. They need to trust us. We build those relationships through play. And the end game for this young man was that he actually then had the confidence to come out to our community play sessions. So you've got somebody that worked one-on-one and wouldn't engage with peers, then coming along because of the trust he had in us to community play sessions. And then we found out through school that he was back in the classroom. So there are bigger forces at work with this young man as well. There are other interventions, but play certainly gave him the ability to take control of his own life and actions.
So just to break that down then, how has that work, that support you've given to that young person, how has that then helped them in their lives?
I think it helps young people because it gives them a toolbox of things that they can deal with, things that they've tried, things that they've done, things that they've learned from. So it's not me giving my life experiences and saying, you know, as an old man, this is the way I did it back when. Yes, I faced the same problems. I cannot say I've faced the same problems as a young person I'm working with. They might be similar, but we're separate entities. So play allows them to use a trial and error, as I say, to stretch their own physical abilities, to stretch their emotional resilience, to really test those boundaries and find out what their own breaking points are and where they can bring themselves back from the brink, I guess, for want of a better phrase.
So is that going to have a consequential benefit on emotional health, confidence, physical health? Do those things come into play then?
Yes, his confidence was high enough that he could then engage in class with his peers. So you've got an educational point of view, but also he was coming on to community play sessions and running around for 2 hours at a time. He was learning through his own abilities, playing a game of football or climbing a tree, or even just sitting down and getting creative and having that whole mindfulness space as well. You learn what works for you. So he quickly found out, I enjoy this. I'm going to do that more often. I'm good at this, so I will then follow it up the next step and run that little bit further or kick that ball a little bit harder.
So what's really interesting is you've started off talking about schools, but it's also very much intrinsically linked to communities, given your example. So if we think now about families, so there's a massive amount of research available, which unsurprisingly shows that there's a really crucial role that parents or caregivers can play in the health of a young person. For any parents or caregivers listening to this, what are some easy ways that anyone can help young people to be creative and to be active through play outdoors or indoors?
I think a lot of it is based on your own perceptions as an adult, and whether you're a caregiver or an adult that circles within a child's remit, it's almost saying yes more often. And I often ask people to go back to when they were 10 years old and to draw a picture of that scene of them at play. I would say 99.9% of the time, the pictures are of sunny days with your mates and no other adults around. So therefore, what we need to do as caregivers is almost give that freedom. But I'm a dad and a play worker, and I understand the balance of that is really hard to find, because all my play work training tells me, send the kids out, let them jump in muddy puddles, let them climb trees, let them go away from my eyesight for hours on end. And then the dad side of me is like, I need to know where they are because I need to keep them safe. Finding the balance between the two, I think, is probably the golden bullet. It's what you need to find. What works for you, what works for your children. There'll be elements where you need to rein them back in, but actually saying yes more often, giving them a little bit of freedom, you'll notice that they build their own toolbox, as I said earlier. They'll build their own ways and means of engaging what is happening in the world around them. And I think that's quite important from a social point of view for young people to learn how to engage with each other. We were all isolated from each other for quite a while. Learning that social interaction can be quite key, and play plays a massive part in that.
So it sounds like there's some impact or some attitudes towards risk in all of this. Do you feel that that's one of the barriers? And what might be other barriers in terms of families embracing play and creative play?
Yep, I think risk becomes a big barrier. Talking to young people, the barriers they tell us about are other children, so bigger kids, essentially, and the perception of other kids. And again, I work with age ranges from 5 up to 25. There's never really one age group that stands out as a troubled age group or ones that you need to avoid. But there's a perception. And I think a lot of the times in young people, that perception is fed back to them by the adults that are in their world because of what we're seeing as adults in our world. So young people are telling us that other children scare them. They're also telling us that things like dog mess and fly tipping in their local green spaces are a thing that stops them wanting to go to a play space. Parents tell us it's traffic, it's the amount of traffic on the roads, it's the perception of an area, or it's that person that I know down the street. There's a lot of who, what, ifs. Then when you break it down into actually what is preventing you going out, it boils down to what access do you have? Do you have access to a green space? Is that green space attractive? Do your parents feel comfortable enough to let you go to that green space on your own, or do they have to come with you? You know, if you're a working adult in a child's world, finding that time and space becomes hard. So there's many different factors. And I think, yeah, risk, you know, you can break it down to, is it risky letting your child go free roaming? Yes, potentially. And then it's your gauge on that risk. What do I know about my local area? What do I perceive about my local area that is preventing me from giving a childhood that I may have had when I was 10 to my 10-year-old?
Okay, so let's give you a scenario then. I'm a dad of 3 very lively little boys. If I am not confident about my local area, but I want to get them out and about playing more, what are some cheap or free things I could do to get them playing more?
There's a gentleman called Simon Nicholson who wrote a paper back in 1971, and it was called How Not to Cheat Children. And it's the theory of loose parts play. And it's something in the playwork world we will stand behind. And loose parts are anything you can find. Simon Nicholson says a beach is the perfect play environment because of the amount of natural light. You've got a mix of alive and dead objects. So you've got nature, but you've got driftwood, you've got sand. If you've ever been to a beach, you know that the wet sand is where you can start drawing with a bit of driftwood. You can have a game of cricket where you build your sandcastles. The soft sand is where you might be having your relaxation. So the beach is the perfect example. We don't all live near a beach. What can we use as parent carers to kind of introduce loose parts? And that is, if you go into the woods and you find a stick, it's use that stick. You don't go to the cinema and you don't shout out, you're not Cinderella, or you're not that person acting. Children are actors. If they get a stick and they're a wizard, go with it. If they say, turn you into a frog, and again, this is almost going back to the risk thing, there's a perception then, if you're a frog hopping along the street, other people might look at you and, you know, as a person, you might go, oh, I don't want them judging me because I'm being a frog hopping along the street. But actually, if you become that frog for that young person, you might only need to do it for 5 minutes, because then they'll go off on their own autopilot when it comes to games. But that 5 minutes with you can be way more powerful than anything else they've had during that day with an adult.
Okay, so it's everything around us that we can use to be childlike within that space. Is that right?
I think, yeah, if you start to see the world through a child's eyes, whether they are your children, whether they're children you know, whether you go back to when you were a child, the world is very playful. There is a lot of things that you can engage with. There are puddles to splash in. It's getting over the fact that shoes are going to get wet and kids are going to moan when they're wet and cold, but that comes further down the track. In that initial moment, the child is leading you, so be led.
Yeah, I always remember I saw a young child absolutely being led by their parent along a street where we used to live, and there was no guidance from the parent. It's quite unusual to see, and they were having an amazing time wandering around, fiddling with bits of walls, and the parent was completely hands off, and the child was having the best time ever. So that's a really good nugget of information that we can all use, and it's fun, right?
It's fun and it's free. You don't need to spend a huge amount of money. If you can go for a walk in your local area, and whether you're in an urban area or a rural area, there is nature all around you. Whether it's dandelions growing up through a crack in the concrete or whether it's a field of sunflowers, you can pick that dandelion and you can discuss the dandelion, or you can make a potion out of it, or if you rub it on your skin, it'll make your skin yellow. There's ways and means of playing without having to spend a fortune.
Fantastic. So you've chatted a little bit around your work in communities. I know you've been doing quite a lot more recently, more work with the NHS and colleagues within the NHS. Can you tell me a little bit more about this?
Yeah, it's really exciting for us actually, because it's putting play into a world that play has never been. Through our work for the last 15 years of the charity, we work in communities primarily, and within communities you've got a range of everyone, all ages, all abilities, all creeds, etc., etc. So when you embrace that and when you embed yourself in a community, and I go back to building trust within communities, when you have that trust, people open up to you. So we are working with children, young people, families that are in need of assistance, whether it's something that they can find within themselves or whether it's something statutory that needs to be in place. The clinical commissioning group work is quite exciting, because when we met with them and we spoke about the type of work that we do and the type of children and young people that we engage with, they had no idea of the level of intervention that was required for these young people that we meet. I'm working with children in care, children that have witnessed domestic violence, have been abused themselves. There's all those sort of horrible things that you hear about. And again, as a parent, that's why you want to keep your kids close to you. We're working with these children, and for the NHS, they were like, wow, we need to look at how we can use play more to build those toolboxes for those individuals and really help them prosper and not be bogged down by the weight of the caseload that is around them.
It's really interesting, and a lot of our emerging work is in this area, Active Gloucestershire. What we seem to see is the NHS under huge pressure, as everyone knows, and it's been asked to react to so many issues now: loneliness, mental health, stress, obesity. The reality is it can only react to this, but it can't address all of the underlying causes of all of these things. And that's why I think there's so much pressure on those NHS services at the minute. Are we really looking at how we can use play and other things like play to improve health through our communities? And do you see play playing an important role in that?
I will always bang the drum for play, because I've seen it work personally as a child playing. It worked for me, but also now as a play worker, I see play working for everybody. Going back to the definition at the start, play is something that you want to do. So therefore, play can be different for everyone, but play is something you want to do. So if you're not sporty, but you're happy running around a park playing tag, you could be doing as much physical exercise as somebody that is part of a sports team. If you are conscious about your own artistic abilities, drawing on pavement with chalk, getting a bit of feedback from your neighbours or your peers, you suddenly then start thinking, oh, actually, I'm not too bad at it. And it's just the little sort of social nudges that play provides to build a bigger framework. I often think the best thing I can do for my kids is to not have them relying on the need for a health service. It was interesting that during the restrictions, we had the Prime Minister in the first time in my lifetime saying, get outdoors and be physically active. And I think the nation gripped that because we were all trapped indoors. Actually, we realized how important being outdoors is for our own mental health. Besides the physical health side, it was the mental health side. But, you know, it's the age-old adage of the mind would lead the body. And therefore, if we're feeling like we're happy to be outside, we're enjoying ourselves, we're doing something we want to do and how we want to do it, play provides that vehicle for children and young people to be more active.
I think it's really exciting to hear you talk about your work and linking in with colleagues in the NHS, using play to connect communities as a way of supporting colleagues in the NHS. Like you say, healthy young people, creating space for those who really need it further down the line. And I just think it's fantastic and really positive to hear that. Can we just think about active environments? So this is one of Sport England's key five priorities as part of their new strategy. We know that spaces and places around us can have a positive and negative impact. You've already talked about this in terms of how and where we move. What have you seen that works really well, and what might be the challenges in this area?
Things that work really well are where open spaces, you don't need really expensive play equipment. It's a bit like when you give a child a toy at Christmas, they probably rather play with a cardboard box than the toy.
So true.
So when you've got a space that affords many different variations of play and physical activity, I think that then becomes a really successful space for the whole community. So the ones that work well are the spaces that aren't age restricted, that aren't all encompassing, you bounce here, you climb here. A lot of great play spaces are ones where you're using the natural resources around you. So if a tree has fallen down, children will investigate that tree. If you've got landscaping, this time of year when it's muddy and slidey, kids will slide down it. But then at the peak of summer, it could be a place where you lay a picnic blanket and sit at the top of it with your friends. So areas that work really well, I think, are ones that embrace nature rather than bung in a load of plastic and metal and make it very, you will do this here. I think the successful play spaces for communities are ones that are potentially on the doorstep of schools so that children can come straight after school into an area where they can almost release. You know, children at school, again, are asked to be quite controlled. You know, control is removed from children. There is a power balance between teachers and children. So giving them that ability to just take the lid off and fizz out into a play space, I think is really positive because it allows the children to almost decompress, but also it gives parents time and space to just have that moment before the tea time grind comes along and you're asking them to get ready for bed, and there's all that thing again of you taking control over a child. Successful community spaces are the ones that flow quite nicely. It could be your walk to school where there's things to climb on, anything like that where it affords a young person a little bit of time to explore, I think is really positive.
Is there an opportunity here then, looking forwards? You and I have talked about the work of Tim Gill. His book is called Urban Playground, looking at how urban spaces can be built with children in mind. Now, obviously, there's a lot of people to bring to the table around that, but is there an opportunity going forwards? Tim Gill will talk about cities like Rotterdam, Oslo, parts of London, where that's happened, it can have a profound effect on the health and well-being of all those communities, including children. What are your thoughts on that and the role play can play within that?
To create a space that is accessible to children, it then becomes a space that's accessible for everybody. Tim mentions children almost being the canary in the cage of a community. If children are playing happily, then you know you have a community that is thriving. As I said before, the risk factors of adults not letting children into a green space will let you know that that green space has a reputation within its community. So bring it straight back. There's a model called the Manchester Circles by Wendy Russell and Stuart Lester, where they put the playful child at the center of every thinking. That's what as a play worker I try and do when I'm engaging with schools, but also when I'm engaging with communities. So if you put that child at the center and you then look at what is around this child, what is the built-up environment, is it child-friendly, can a child play here? If the answer is inherently no, as a community, you've got issues. If children cannot roam freely, cannot access their green space because there's a dual carriageway in the way, you're going to have problems. It might not be immediate, but as we've said before, those children are not going to be as physically active as the children in the postcode over from them. So you're going to be having problems further down the track. But putting a child at the center of everything, you then can change policy. You can change procedures based on what is making this accessible to young people. Tim and his colleagues and the urban designers will know way more than I will, but I think if you can create something where walking routes, cycle routes are accessible and well lit, and there's plenty of, you know, loose parts to engage with on the way, to climb, to jump, to sit, it then suddenly becomes something people want to do. You want to walk to school, you want to cycle to work. That then builds a snowball effect in terms of, well, yeah, I'm feeling better about myself, I've cycled to work, so then I'm going to go to the park with the kids after work because actually I'm in a better space. From my point of view, it will always be the child at the centre. Are children and young people accessing these areas that they can really flourish in? And Tim talks openly about places like Oslo, like you say, where they put children first. And it's not changing the adult world. I often see adults will engage with play equipment as well.
Of course.
You know, who wouldn't? So we've all got that playful child within us as well. So it's making those areas, as I say, you don't want to bung in a load of brightly plastic slides that not all ages can access. But if you've got cycle routes or paths along a stream or whatever that has access to that stream, people will dip their toe in the heat of summer. And yeah, I think it's really allowing people to engage with nature and their community.
So Ben, to make this happen, who are we talking to? Is it policymakers, planners? It's a whole range of people, I presume.
I talk to children first. The children in the community will soon tell you what they want and how they want it. They'll give you blue sky ideas for sure. That's where, as a play worker that has that trust with them, you can almost rein them back in again and go, maybe we won't have the swimming pool on the moon this time, but you're into physical activity because you've mentioned swimming. So let's see what we can do. Putting children in front of policymakers, putting children in front of town planners, you're almost asking those people higher up the food chain to make a moral decision. If children are saying, we want this, and they're saying it upfront and personal, and then policymakers still say no, there's a moral conflict there within that policymaker. So I wouldn't use children as a tool in that way, but I would always be the voice for children. If they're not confident enough to say it, I would be more than happy to invite a counsellor or a developer to come and have a chat with the kids whilst they're at play. Look at how they play. Children in a green space where there's nothing, they might be climbing trees. So you know that climbing equipment is something they're keen on. First and foremost, look at the child, ask the child what they want, look at the realities of that, and then really challenge policymakers to put that child at the centre of everything they think about.
It's such a fascinating and massive area. Thank you so much for coming in today. I'm so pleased we could do this. We've talked about it for long enough.
Yeah, it's been fun.
It's been great fun. It'd be great to have a follow-up in 6 to 12 months. Thank you very much, Ben Morris from Play Gloucestershire.
Thank you, Tom.
This podcast was recorded at Real World Studios in Bath. It was produced and directed by Catherine Cunning, with sound engineering from Katie May, music by Tom Beasley.